extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Now, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental Tire from the AT&T 5G Virtual Studios. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, Matt Doyle, Kaylin Carr, David Goss. MLS Cup is set. Down to two teams, one game, all decided on December 11th, 3 p.m. Eastern, ABC, TSN, Unimas, TVA Sports, Timbers, NYCFC. Couple four seeds just punching their way through the bracket. Here we are. Here it is. How you guys feeling? Big show today. We're going to talk through it. Both conference finals. Of course, a little first look at the MLS Cup matchup. We have Jamie Vardy on this show. It's a real grab bag of everything you want and need from Major League Soccer.
Guess what you know now? It's what? Always a party with Jamie Vardy.
Ah, didn't see that coming. I wonder if we got laughs from anybody out there.
Biggest Leicester City fan on the show right now.
Nice. What do you think of the cup matchup? That brought us down just a little bit. Let's get back up. Let's bring it right back up.
I like Doyle's audible groan there.
You know what this is? This is a moment in time, a moment in history that we've seen before, maybe just not in a final. This is an MLS is back quarterfinal rematch. Hit rewind.
Revenge match.
All the revenge. Timbers won that one, just throwing it out there. How do we feel about this matchup, this MLS Cup matchup, Doyle? How do you feel about where we ended this season? All these matches, all these shows, all this time spent, and we end with Timbers, NYCFC from Providence Park.
Well, it says that advanced analytics are the way to go, because NYCFC, by the advanced numbers, was the best team in the league this year. And it also says that advanced analytics are absolute trash because Portland, by the numbers, were one of the worst teams in MLS this year. So I love the chaos of it. Portland has certainly been a lot better by the numbers and the eye test, and obviously by the one loss record since that humiliating loss to Seattle in mid-August. And what they've been able to do in terms of not just shoring up their set piece defense, but becoming a dominant team on attacking set pieces. That's reminiscent of last summer at the MLS's back tournament. Like, that's how they scored their four or five final goals in winning that trophy. So we're getting flashbacks of that. And as for NYCFC, I said this, on last night's show, and I wrote it a couple of times. Like, when they were playing good this year, I don't think anybody in the league played better soccer than them. They're able to get on the ball and sort of dictate where on the field the game is played and the tempo it's played at, and turn that into lots and lots of chances. They didn't turn it into as many goals as you would like to see if you were a Pigeons fan. But like the underlying stuff loves them for that particular reason. And we've seen it come to bear in these playoffs, man. They just won at New England. They just won at Philadelphia. And look, I know that it wasn't a full strength Union team, but it was not an easy place to win. And they deserve to be in the MLS Cup final. And Portland absolutely deserves to host it. So I'm looking forward to it.
Providence Park, first ever time hosting. It feels right. Have we all been to a game at Providence Park? Everybody? No? Yes?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, perfect. Perfect. How do you feel about that, Kaylin, as the venue for an MLS Cup final?
Oh, it's wonderful. If you were to spin the globe of MLS cities that hadn't hosted yet an MLS Cup that you felt would be a deserving host, Portland might be the best spot to land on of the places that haven't hosted yet. All due respect to my Dynamo, which, but we're sort of nowhere close to that right now.
I thought
you
were going to pick Fire there, but,
Oh, the Fire as well. Yeah. Yeah. Both clubs.
Dream a little dream, Fire and Dynamo fans.
But Portland, I mean, it's for everybody who's been there and even playing there, it's an incredible atmosphere. I flew out to a game when I was injured just to go watch. And I sat in the crowd and I got permission from the team to take a break from my rehab, flew my mom up, had a couple beers in the crowd. It was amazing. Like, it's such a cool, it has so much history to it. They've left a lot of it intact as well. So you kind of walk around the concourse and it's just the sunken down field in the middle of the city. And a part, you know, that it's a part of the fabric of Portland, like the whole city, you know, it's one of those cities where, you know, there's a match. And this is going to be kind of take that to the nth degree. From a player's perspective, it is a difficult, I think probably the most difficult place to play away. Kansas City is up there for me. Seattle is loud, but it's like kind of abstract. It's so loud you can't really hear. Whereas Portland, it's just oppressive. It's like right on top of you. And for the away team, you have to walk across the pitch to get you, because there's not sort of like a easy place to arrive. So you have to walk across the pitch. And even for like a regular season match, Timbers Army is in there like an hour and a half before the game. You're not expecting anybody to be there. You walk through plenty of empty stadiums a couple hours before the match. They're packed. You got to walk by them to get to the locker room. So they're going to be jumping before this match. So I think a perfect host. And then NYCFC have done such an amazing job. You just look at the path going through to take down the Red, you know, Atlanta, and then to take down the Revs, especially. I thought that was the best match of the playoffs by far, and the best quality. And New York City were the best team that day. They were the better team on the pitch. This one was a little bit weird, but they don't have Tati Castellanos in this one. They get it back for the final, so they'll have a full strength team. I think we didn't see the best of them in this last match, I think partly because he was missing, as well as just the changing dynamic of those absent players from Philly, who I'm definitely thinking about today, gutted the way they had to sit out and watch their season end. And credit to the players for fighting, and Jim Curtin for, you know, even making this a game was really, really impressive from them. But for NYCFC, I think they'll have a much more clear plan going into this one. And they were kind of a little bit like caught in between two minds in this last one of like suddenly becoming the favorite and not quite knowing what to do with that. They sorted out at halftime, but I'd expect them to be a much more cohesive team and look more like the team we saw playing against the Revs the match before.
When's your flight, Dave? You got it booked?
No, not yet.
You ready to go?
I am ready to go.
Yeah, Kaylin, I think you'll be there too, but you know, poor Doyle and I, we watch from home.
Yeah, families, man. You know, you both have kids. Doyle's got two. You've got two.
I don't know which family disrupts our tapings more. I actually think it is probably General South Taquito that disrupt this show more than my insane brood.
Your children are perfectly behaved.
I locked the door. Don't let them down here. That's the key.
But it'll be my fourth Providence Park game, three Seattle-Portland games, and now MLS Cup. So my hit rate's pretty high on quality, and I'm excited. It's as big an event as you can have. Kaylin, you know, touched on all of it. The city's going to be all about it. And we've been to cups now in Atlanta and Toronto where, you know, you can feel the event, Seattle, where you can feel the event happening in the city and it being the biggest thing that everyone's talking about. And that's going to be the case this year. So I think it's as good an environment as you can have. And as Doyle mentioned, NYCFC is as good a team as you can have in it. And I think the performance against RSL, even without Blanco, was as good as we've seen Portland over the last 2 months. So you got two teams peaking, playing in front of the best atmosphere that MLS can put together. It kind of has all the ingredients.
I just want to say, you know, as we talk about like, you know, the playoff format and seeds and who gets advantage from what, this is sort of the classic MLS situation of two teams that were scuffling a little bit, like late summer, early fall. I mean, NYCFC, there was a possibility they weren't even going to make this MLS Cup playoffs. Like, they were hanging around the seven and rose at the end. Well, they found momentum. They found something that worked. Here they are. Again, I'll say it. Both four seeds, they got to start at home and build a little bit of momentum into these playoffs. Before we dig into the conference finals and the nitty-gritty, I just want to throw this stat out there and get your guys' reaction to it. This is the seventh straight MLS Cup final with either the Timbers or the Sounders. 2015, Portland won it. 2016, Seattle won it. 2017, Seattle lost. Portland lost in 2018. Seattle won again in 19. Seattle lost last year. Now Portland's back. What does that say to you, Doyle? That we just, these two teams from the West.
Still wearing a Timbers t-shirt? Right,
is he?
Yeah, I got
it. It is green and yellow.
2014 All-Star Game t-shirt. Nice. Yeah, a lot of my wardrobe.
Why are you asking the bias,
A lot of my wardrobe is free t-shirts from All-Star Games over the years. I'm particularly fond of the...
Oh, wait, hold on. And this hoodie, I recognize this zip up here. Yeah, that's a free one. Absolutely. Yep, I recognize that.
This guy's an influencer.
Or I can be from 2014. I can be very influenced is actually what this is. honestly, like it says something for consistency and the, you know, having the ability to stick with a vision and build on it year over year after year and not panic and not make rash moves. It also says something about getting the right number six into the team. You know, the start of Seattle's run was built on like Ozzy Alonso. I know that obviously there were other great players, but like Ozzy Alonso was the six. And then as he sort of aged out or they decided to move off of him, they had Gustav Svensson for 2 or 3 years. And then they moved to João Paulo. Like all of those guys are, you know, top three or four in the league at the position in any given year during that stretch. And the same for Diego Chara. Like if you get that position right, you're probably going to be at the worst, not bad. And then if you start getting the number 10 correct and you get a really good number 9 and you get a couple of good defenders in there as well, then your ceiling is going to MLS Cup every year. And so that's what we've seen from Seattle and Portland. Like the D-mid is still the most important position on the field. It is still the most important position on the field. And they still have Diego Chara and he's 35 years old and he moves around like he's 25. And so they're going to be pretty good every single year.
And he looked phenomenal this weekend. I would argue the other things are in MLS, because it's a salary cap league, you need players that are maybe undervalued. And if you're an undervalued player, why not go play in front of 45,000 in Seattle or Providence Park? And I think they have the ability to get players in where you spend money on Raul Ruiz Diaz, you spend money on Diego Valeri, you need a Shane O'Neill to play well for you. Or you look at Chad Marshall. Chad Marshall probably could have tried to push to go to other teams. But why would you when you're playing for cups and you're playing in that atmosphere and in that city week in and week out? Jordan Morris, obviously the same conversation from the beginning. So I think that talks about the value that the culture and the city has for the teams and helps them stay relevant. It also tells you that, while Doyle mentioned not making rash decisions, rebuilds in MLS shouldn't actually take that long. Like it's a parity-driven league and the point that they can flip from Ozzy Alonso and stay good in Seattle or for Portland to now have sort of moved off Diego Valeri and stay good and have both these clubs have missed on a ton of DPs and yet they've stayed relevant the year after shows that if you want to, you can.
All right, last quick note here and we'll get into the details. I just want to throw it out there. Since 2011, when a participant hosted in 2011, LA Galaxy were at a quote-unquote neutral site in Carson. Kaylin knows something about that. And then in 2012, it was actually they were better in the regular season than the Dynamo, so they did host it. Since 2011, home teams in MLS
by
Cup.
By one point.
Hey, that was a big point.
Old stuff.
Look, you can't get a result. You can't get a draw, Kaylin. You can't host MLS Cup then. All right? Fair. That's the way it works. They're 8-2, our home teams. The last four MLS Cups have been won by the home team, Toronto, Atlanta, Seattle, and Columbus. The only two away teams to win, one of which was the Portland Timbers, who were the first to do it in 2015. And then it was Seattle, who did it on, I want to just say it again, no shots on goal in 2016. So, look, it's an upward climb for NYCFC in this one. Real quick, before we get into the conference finals, some other big news for MLS Cup. Not the same ball, at least in design, is going to be used in this match. The 2022 ball is getting the call up a little bit earlier. Have you guys seen this ball? Have you witnessed its greatness?
It brings flowers like from both vibes. The U.S., Canada, yeah, and around the world.
Can I just say that the Canadian flower is the bunch berry, which I find incredibly interesting, and the U.S. one is the rose, which is far less interesting than that. But this incorporates the national flowers of the U.S. and Canada, as well as colors representing the other homelands of MLS players. Representing, they say, the 860 players of MLS hailing from 79 different countries. It's cool. I like it. It sort of looks like you chopped up like a Hawaiian shirt and just sort of like cut and pasted on a soccer ball. I like it. I need it. I want it in my background right now. How do you guys feel about the new ball? Any strong takes?
Is the rose is the national flower of the United States? Is that what you
apparently
just said?
That's so? Does this
give Portland an advantage?
Oh, in the Rose City? Didn't make that connection.
I'm just saying. Like,
are there trilliums on this?
That's why you're here. That 2014 shirt gives you superpowers of deduction.
What's the official flower of New York City? Do we have flowers here?
Yeah. I don't know. Somebody who knows more than we will can tell us that. But new ball in the final. I think it looks pretty cool.
I got you. I got you.
All right. Hit us up. We got
I don't know tulip? If this is true. I'm seeing daffodils.
Daffodils.
I just Googled official flower of New York and it's the rose. That's New York State. That's New York State. The daffodil is in fact the official flower of New York City.
Oh wow. Trying to undercut you.
I was right.
You were right.
Yeah, you were right. Yeah. All right.
Doyle as a Connecticut person doesn't know the difference between New York State. In New York City.
It's all the same.
It's all over the place. Yeah.
It's basically the same.
Doyle's normally hanging out around Albany, Binghamton.
Yeah, just commuting in. So, you know, it's just all one big blur as you ride the train south. Rochester, New York FC, baby. We are going to talk about that in a little bit. Of course, coming up in a little bit. MLS Next Pro. That is the name of the new league for MLS, bridging the gap between MLS Next and Major League Soccer. We're going to have a quick look at MLS Cup coming in a second and much, much more. Go to MLSsoccer.com.
We're doing, 12, 15 minutes on the CPL final? Luka's first career.
Yeah, trophy. LAFC might cut into that time. There's no news there, but we just have a quota we got
to
fill.
Wow. Shout out to Pacific FC for winning their first ever CPL championship yesterday. It was great on the road at Forge. Epic game. And the kids got it done. There you go. There's
nice.
My try.
Congratulations. Yeah, congratulations to Pa. Charlie Bohm has three takeaways from the Eastern Conference Final on MLSsoccer.com. James Sands has a legendary F-bomb-laced interview also up at the site. We had to delay the post-game show to make sure we got the proper bleeps in for Mr. Sands, who was about it when he got the microphone stuck in front of his face. And Steve Zakwani has your...
I want to know what his, if he wins MLS Cup, what is the, Josie after, you know, a whole night of partying and... PhD rooftop in Manhattan.
He understands. If he says the right things, he will get into the ETR intro. That's the way these things work. And that's the sort of history.
Fortunately, James Sands turned 21 on July 6th, so it would be okay for him to have his Josie interview moment.
Perfect. Steve Zakwani had your three takeaways from the Western Conference Final. Of course, all the coverage, MLSsoccer.com, of every single thing happening in these Audi 2021 MLS Cup playoffs and beyond, because there's a lot of news outside the league as well. All right, let's talk Eastern Conference. You know, you sort of mentioned it there, Kaylin, and it was the biggest story here. League health and safety protocols in MLS ruled 11 union players out. I mean, this is like a who's who of the club. It's the captain, Alejandro Bedoya. It's maybe the best goalkeeper in the league, and Andre Blake. It's two starting center backs that have been the rock of this team for the better part of a year plus, and Jack Elliott and Jakub Glesnes. It's Sergio Santos. It's Alvis Powell, who had started right back. It's Kai Wagner, who's their left back. It's Quinn Sullivan. It's Elsinho, who could have impacted this game off the bench, along with Corey Burke. It's Joe Bendick, the backup goalkeeper. I mean, they had a league pool goalkeeper on the bench for the Union. It was a big deal, and it changed the night, certainly, for Philadelphia. They weren't able to get it done. 2-1 winners were NYCFC, Tyus Magno with the game-winning goal in the 88th. Hebert started, so if you want to start with... You know, rubbing it in, Dave, I'll just say that Charlie and I were right that Hebert wasn't ready to perform
wrong.
In that moment, but he was the starter.
You were wrong.
That part is true.
You started with, we were right about something that you were just wrong.
I started with,
There's
you were right,
yes,
and
no.
then I said we were right.
There's a yes, no. There's not like, oh, here's the shades of gray. You were wrong, I was right.
Fine, we got that out of the way. This was a tough night for the Union, but a wonderful one for NYCFC, Kaylin. Let's just start with the Union side and try to get the big news story out of the way here. I mean, this is, it's a real shame. It's a real shame. I just want to, we've been going through this as a society for a long time now, and you've probably lived along with it on Extra Time. And this is one of the unfortunate, it's just one of the unfortunate realities of our world here. And of the world of professional sports in that they were not able to play in this game. But that is so cruel for a team that had gotten to this point and had this once in a club opportunity. They'd never been there before. This was it, man. And to have to watch that from home and to see your team crash out, and for all those players that did play, what an incredible performance and effort. But what a shame. What a shame.
Brutal. And you think about what it might be like to wake up today, and it would probably feel pretty surreal just because you go through the entire season and from preseason all the way through, you know, and you're dodge, you know, we're all, you're traveling, you're trying to be as safe as possible, whatever it is, and living around this whole thing as we all are, but to not play a part in a match of this scale and magnitude in your career, there's no guarantee you get back to that. You know what I mean? And it just from my memories of my playing career, like, I've missed games, I've had injuries, suspension, same thing, but those are things that you that happen within the scope of the field, right? And NYCFC was missing some players as well, for those reasons. But this was something that is, you know, you almost can't really imagine. And the scope and scale of it was also a big part of the story. And then also when it happened, the fact that it was, you know, during the week, just about like, you know, 48 to 78 hours or 72 hours before the match, they missed a practice. They don't know who's available, who's not available. You try and work on set pieces. You try and work on structure. Can you field an 11? Are there more people coming? Like, it's just an impossible task to figure out. And credit to Jim Curtin, because I really thought they were the better team in the first half. Like, for all of the things that they had gone through, they gave a really good account of themselves, and a lot of the young players as well. I thought McGlynn was really good. Freeze came up with a big save.
Flock probably played his best game. Flock was awesome.
Yeah,
Flock was awesome. Everywhere, all over the pitch. Finley was strong. Aurelien Collin had played, I think, 1 minute in a couple years. Like, he was playing against me in these Eastern Conference finals and got pulled back out onto the field. He was supposed to go maybe 50, 60 minutes, they were thinking, and then make a substitution. He ended up going the distance. So, you know, just like an incredible. And I think as the game went on and New York City made some halftime adjustments where they were able to be a little bit more aggressive, I think, you know, the halftime interview was really illuminating to that point where Dilo said, we're going to get push our sixes forward, try and take a more advanced position, because they were pretty passive. And they looked, if they looked like the team that had made a ton of changes and were completely disjointed, while the Union were the team that had a little bit more cohesiveness and understanding as far as what the game plan was and really seemed to feed off the crowd, and just being in the game was giving them life. Anytime they got a foul, they would move up the pitch and the crowd would go wild.
They took
and so, you know, then
no, they took every time they won a foul, they took the free kick quickly. Every time they won a throw in, they took the throw in quickly, and it was clearly part of the game plan to just get NYCFC on their heels and keep them on their heels. And I thought it was the right game plan. And look, you made the right point that the Union, even with this handicap of missing five starters and their top subs, gave a really good account of themselves and played really good soccer for about an hour. And obviously, not having those starters did have an impact down the stretch, but I think what had a bigger impact was that the Union just don't have the type of final third quality that we associate with top teams in this league. NYCFC was able to bring a $10 million guy in off the bench, and he won them the game. The Union do not, even if Corey Burke and Sergio Santos were there.
But he won them the game on a tap-in after someone whiffed on a clearance and a backup left back.
No, I mean, the backup left back is a very good international caliber player. I'm saying that the Union had their starting center forward, their starting number 10, their starting imported big signing in Daniel Gajdag. They had, you know, two other starting central midfielders in there, and they just didn't have the quality in the final third. And for a team that I thought controlled 60 minutes of the game, they had their starting players in there, and they did not create all that much. And to me, that is almost like the bigger story than the missing players. Because, like, the question with the Union is the same question that we had about them last year in the playoffs, and the same question that we had about them 3 months ago against Club America in the CONCACAF Champions League semifinals. It's like, do they have the match winners for this kind of stage? And whether or not they would have had their defense, you know, their starting defenders in there, the answer is no. The answer is no. Against the Red Bulls, it took until 123rd minute, And you know, Jakob Glesnes scoring in a banger from 30 yards against Nashville. It went to a shootout. They just don't have the attacking horses for these types of games. And that was going to be true whether or not there were any health and safety protocols that kept these players out of the game. And look, I think they deserve all the credit in the world for getting this far. They are clearly one of the best coached teams in the league. They have a robust internal culture of next man up, gets the job done, and that can take you places. I don't think it can take you to MLS Cup unless you have better players in the attacking third.
We'll never know because they didn't have them available.
They had their starters available, Kaelin. They had their starters available. They had Jamiro Montero, Daniel Gajdag, and Kasper Schipilko. And obviously Sergio Santos would have helped, but Sergio Santos, we came on this show for the past 2 weeks saying like, oh man, he opens up the game, but he can't score goals. You know, this is where it was always going to end for the Union with this group of players. I don't think it could.
Okay, you don't think Andre Blake potentially holds on to that save?
I mean, potentially.
Or parries it further wide?
I mean,
it's a question. It's just a question.
No, for sure. Yeah. But are we letting the Union attack and front office off the hook scoring zero run of play goals in three games?
No one's disagreeing with that. I think the point is the one goal may have been enough to get them to win if those guys were there. No one's disagreeing with you that the attack hasn't been good enough, that the investment in the attack hasn't been good enough from Philly. And I would argue that it doesn't have to be Rui Diaz.
No.
If you bring someone else in who's solid and consistent, someone similar to what Eber has been in the past, let's say, for NYCFC, or you look at the guys that Portland's brought in, whatever it is, even up top alongside Schipilko, like that's probably enough for this team to create a difference, and they haven't been able to do that. They haven't done it in the entire time.
If they had everybody and then they lost to NYCFC in this manner and Sergio Santos, you know, couldn't finish, kept getting in behind and skied all of his chances, and Burke, you know, had a sitter, Schipilko missed an easy one or whatever, then I think that's a fair point.
We saw that for two games.
We did, and they advanced for two games. So my point is more that we don't know. Like, to make that sort of statement, we don't know because they didn't have the opportunity to sort of have that judgment in this game. And, like, I just think, you know, as the game went on, it was always going to favor the depth at piece. And I hear what you're saying about the starters. They coped pretty well. It was really once the changes were made where New York City just had way more weapons to go to on the bench. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they had, you know, a $10 million player or, you know, whatever, wherever the money, I think there was a comment about where the money comes from or whatever it was. But I thought that was always going to favor NYCFC as them. And the other part is the experience piece. And we talked about the inexperience. The inexperience shows up. They showed up in this one in you score a goal and then you give up a goal in the next minute. And that's a moment where you would like to have a leader like Alejandro Bedoya on the pitch to sort of say, hey, you know, we've had this incredible moment where we get this goal, but we need to not concede in this next minute. Or just his presence to make sure that everybody is tuned in, where Mbizo just shuts off and takes too big of a risk there, where he sees the player. It looks like he didn't get caught blindsided. He saw the player, but just it's too casual. And that's the point where I think that experience of maybe having some of that leadership on the pitch or that depth really sort of showed it there. So I just have a trouble saying that this was because the Union didn't have enough quality, because they didn't have the option of the quality that they had. It wasn't available to them.
But Kaelin,
you can make a comment on whether
guys weren't coming in the first 60 minutes anyway. We're talking about the first 60 minutes. The Union had the game. The Union were on the front foot. The Union were putting NYCFC under pressure. And credit to NYCFC, who's been a very good defensive team through three games. Like, they didn't offer much at all to Atlanta. They, I thought, did a really nice job of keeping the Revs in check. But, like, if you're putting a team under pressure for 60 minutes and you can't create anything other than an own goal, then, like, you have to start, like, that's a commentary on the quality of the starting players for the Philadelphia Union. And that has held true throughout the playoffs. And I don't like the Union need to invest. Look at the types of players who are winning title or getting their teams to MLS Cup final. Tyus Magno costs a lot of money, and he hasn't been great, but he's put the ball in the back of the net for NYCFC. And look at what Santiago Moreno did for Portland this weekend. Yeah, these are significant investments. It's a different ball game than the Union have played with their acquisitions, and I think it ends up being telling in games like this, and it certainly was on the day in this one. Though I will concede Andre Blake saves that.
I'm not against the Union going out and spending some money and giving Jim some more weapons in the attack. I just think if you were to take out the starting back line, you're one of the best goalkeepers in the league, and you take out the central midfielder captain of your team, and then your two best options off the bench up top of any team in MLS. Do that to the Timbers. See what happens.
No, you're absolutely
do that.
You're absolutely right, and that's what I mean about Philadelphia having a great and robust next man up culture, and they are maybe the best team in the league as an example of that, and they should be applauded. And because of that, this game came down more to the lack of quality that they have in the attacking third than the missing pieces at the back. I just think we've been seeing it in big games for the Union for years and years and years. They don't have match winners.
I think Blake is.
That's fair.
I don't think my only point is I don't know if you need match winners only in the attack. I think they've found that they have match winners for them in other places.
That's fair. I mean,
we talked a lot about.
Obviously, Andre Blake is a star, right? He is a tier one star in this league, and if he's in there, Matt Freese had a pretty nice game, but he did not cover himself in glory on that quick equalizer from NYCFC. But again, I'm talking about the Union's attack, and you can't just win every game by shutout, man. It doesn't happen that way. You need to turn that game control, that pitch control, into goals, and they don't have guys to do it in these games.
NYCFC's side, I mean, I think we've covered that Philly side pretty good, and I know where NYCFC fans are right now. They're screaming at me in my Twitter mentions about how we got to put some respect on their name, etc. This was the biggest win, the biggest game, the biggest moment by far, Dave, in this club's history. I mean, it's not even close. This is what they've been, they've been trying to build to this for a long time, and they've gotten the regular season right, and they've had some turnover in the coaching side where the Union have it, and that goes to what you're saying, Doyle, about building a culture and having sort of the ability to cope with adversity the way the Union did. I mean, this is everything for NYCFC. They're finally in a final. They're here. They could win silverware. They did it in the playoffs. We've been saying for years, okay, well, you can do it in the regular season. You can't do it in the playoffs. What did this mean for them? What is this moment for them?
Yeah, I would say for NYCFC, it's been every round kind of like exercising the demons. I think the opening round versus Atlanta was to what you said of the playoffs of they didn't make the mistakes. They were able to capitalize on the mistakes. That's been their biggest issue in the postseason is they play the better soccer in the game. And then a big key mental mistake kind of puts them behind. And they didn't do that in the first round. Then the second round is probably one of the performances of the playoffs. To go to New England, to outplay them, to be able to close it out, even giving up the goal, but still getting to penalties, down a man, sort of two men, because of the injuries they had. That was the performance. That was the we're the best team in this league. We beat the best team in this league. Like all of that for NYCFC. And then you come into this one, and this is why you win to get there, because now Philly loses 11 players, and you're looking at a situation where you're favorites probably going into a road game, which is a rare opportunity. And then what you look at with NYCFC is the idea and the understanding at the beginning of their franchise's history of trying to build stars top down to switching that and saying building out depth and creating depth at every position. And that's what you saw in this game. Not just you're missing Tati, you're missing Keaton Parks, you're missing Anton Tinnerholm, three of the best players on your team, three of the most important players on your team. Tati may be MVP of the league. But then the ability to change the game off the bench, even down those players, right? To be able to still have pieces to come off the bench. And Ronnie Dyla has built a team that fits for him. Or he hasn't. Maybe the bell is telling me I'm wrong. He has built a team that fits for him, and he had the ability to, with the players he brought off the bench, change the way they played. And again, they were able to play more aggressive. They were able to move their pieces higher up the field. I think there wasn't a ton of interchange in that first half, and yeah, there wasn't a lot of use of the ball on the ground. And so then in the second half, you move all that. The first goal is a shot from Alfredo Morales, right? And that's what you're talking about with the Sixes playing higher up the field. And be able to get them higher up the field. Maxi Morales was good again. Always, you know, always a factor, always around the ball. And Santiago Rodriguez, these are the two best games maybe we've ever seen him play. Yeah. So to have him peaking at this time was impressive for this coaching staff. And to be able to bring a lot of young players in the attack to get them to this moment, right? Talis Magno, as much as he costs, that's a teenager living in a foreign country who scores you the game-winning goal. Santiago Rodriguez as well. So for a coaching staff and a club, it's not easy to get those players comfortable and make their lives easy enough for them to perform at that level in a moment like this. And so I think it shows you the holistic approach top-down for NYCFC to kind of hit on every facet of the league mechanisms and to do the work, I think, outside of the salary cap off the field to make those players comfortable, to have the training center, to have the different ways where you're helping them get housing and all those things. I think they've been able to integrate foreign players as well as anyone in this league.
By the way, Ronnie Dial at the beginning of the season, and we talked about it, said, hey, my team's not good enough. Need reinforcements. Who made differences in these postseason? Santi Rodriguez. He came in. Alfredo Morales. He came in during this period. Tati didn't come in, but he wasn't the same player last year. They helped him level up. Tavon Gray. They sold Joe Scally. That could have been their right back. Well, it's another homegrown in Tavon Gray. Well, James Sands is a homegrown who they progressed to this point to being a big part of the U.S. national team this season. He made that difference. Off the bench, Tyus Magno, Malte Edmondson. He came in this season on a transfer. Like, they went out and did the business, and then that business got the job done in big moments during the season. And as you said, Dave, they were able to weave it all together. I mean, look at the stability that a Chanot and Kayans gives you for many, many years now. Like, this is the basis of success in MLS. You talk about the number six. Well, it's also center back pairings. Like, they've figured it out. They figured out how to build to the right point, and they didn't have to do it, you know, at the beginning. Remember, you know, I'm not saying the original teams, because some of the players on those teams, there's some question marks there, but it's not the Pirlos, the Lampards. It's a different way of doing business. It's a head coach that was willing to come out and say, we need more, and then he got more. They went out and made that happen. The scouting network paid off. The investment paid off. And James Sands, to his credit afterwards, after he dropped those F-bombs, said, this is a different team. And James Sands has seen these other teams. We are together in a different way. We fight for each other in a different way. And I thought it was pretty incredible for him to stand there and say, you probably haven't seen that in the past. Mm. Just Maxi Morales. Think about how he changed the club. You know, you're talking about Daniel Gazdag. I'm sorry. Maxi Morales is a better player by far. By far. And once, by far.
He's also like 12 years older.
Yeah. And still he's a better player. That's what.
Okay.
Yes, but yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, that you invested in him, you made the right scouting decision, you brought him into your club, you created an environment that he could thrive in from 2017 on, MVP caliber seasons, and then when he got more space in the midfield, that is in large part how this game changed.
Yeah.
He's an orchestrator. He gets the ball to the feet of the right guys, they switch the attack, their wide players are more dangerous. Those dangerous moments cause mistakes from Mbizo or Freeze or whoever else, causes chaos, and they win 2-1.
So you've said scouting a couple times. That's the strength. That's the investment for this club. And obviously it comes from the City Football Group, but it's the ability that you have a team in Uruguay that you're not watching tape and then calling someone and asking what Santi Rodriguez is like. You have your own coaching staff that knows your club inside and out, and that is on the ground, meeting him, seeing him, playing against him, game in and game out. You talk about Maxime Chanot playing in Belgium. City Football Group owns a team in Belgium, right? So these are not shots in the dark, and that's why they are able to be so successful. And in this league, if you hit on guys that are in any way undervalued, right? And so you talk about Chanot and Collins. Once you set up a center back pairing, look at what Elliott and Glesnes do for Philly. You are competitive every game, flat out, and Sean John behind them. And so no matter who...
I was wondering when someone was going to mention
Sean John. I know. We jumped over him weirdly in that whole conversation.
I shouldn't have jumped over him, because maybe the best moment of this entire night is Sean John sneaking up behind the entire team and lifting the trophy. I mean, this is... You know, I remember when he was going to go to Atlanta, then he wasn't, then he was in NYCFC, and he's like, God, I'm an Atlanta guy, or, you know, I'm a Georgia guy, that's my home, what just happened to me? and then look what he's been able to accomplish. Look what he's become with NYCFC. You know, I mean, that moment is special for him, for the club, no matter what you think about any of it. Like, for Sean John to be the guy that has mitts on that Eastern Conference Final trophy, and we can argue all we want about what that trophy means, but for this club, it means that they get the chance to do something that they've been dreaming about since the very beginning and have never sniffed, have choked it out in the moments when they might have made a run, when they had a team good enough to do so. Thank you for bringing him up. I should have been waxing poetic much earlier about Sean John.
There you go.
I apologize. Do we want to wrap this up? Any final thoughts on this match or NYCFC or what this would mean to them or the upcoming? We're going to dive into the final real quick and do first thoughts there. But this game in particular, is there anything that we want to add, that we want to pile up?
I just want to praise.
To win a first trophy.
Okay. Right.
Isn't that everything? Sorry, Doe. You go.
No, I just wanted to praise Ronnie Dyla for that halftime speech again. Like, he was so candid and so specific about the way he was going to change his team tactically and in terms of pulling the sixes up and pushing the line higher and then, you know, criticizing his starters for not attacking space. And, like, he meant it, because within, like, 5 minutes of the second half, he had, like, three guys coming in off the bench, like, getting ready to come in before the hour mark. And, you know, those three guys obviously they won the game, you know, and they made a huge impact in terms of moving that Union back line around a little bit. Like, Tyus Magno was a lot more mobile, and like, he was basically doing a Tate Castellanos impression, which Eber could not do. And then the interchange between him and Tajiri Strati was, I thought, a lot more natural than what we saw out of Eber and Medina. Medina had a not great game. And with Tajiri Strati coming inside a little bit, it allowed NYCFC to kind of get Gray a little bit higher and start hitting big left to right switches and a couple right to left switches as well, that opened up Philadelphia horizontally. And that creates gaps. And when there are gaps in the defense, Maxi Morales finds them. And like, that is how he tilted the field. He didn't go into quite that much detail at halftime, but he basically said, this is how it's going to happen. And then it did. That was really cool to see. And I loved how upfront about it he was.
I would love, we'll talk about this after the season. Never mind. I would love to see Jesus Medina play deeper on the field. He is so clean on the ball, and then you get into the final third, and everything melts down for him.
Nagby heat map.
But between the two thirds, he looks great. And we've seen him, I think, what was his second year, sort of pull deeper a couple times. So, because when you watch them play, especially against the Revs, any good attack that comes down the left side, if Santiago Rodriguez hasn't pinched in field to be the guy on the end of it, then you get a ball cut back or crossed to Medina, which he missed two sitters to beat Revs before they went to extra time. So that's the only thing I'll say.
He did have a hot streak at the beginning of the season. You gotta give him that. So he had that moment for him. Congratulations to NYCFC. It's a huge moment for the club. We'll see what they can do with it. As I said, recent history being the visitor in MLS Cup, not the best. Portland are hosting it, though. They get to do this. They get to have the party at Providence Park. There's maybe not a better experience, in my opinion, in American soccer than before the game at Providence Park. Wandering around the neighborhood, seeing the stadium sort of rise out of nowhere, having a beer, walking out of the stadium. 10 feet later, you're having a beer somewhere, and it's just packed with fans, packed with people that love exactly what you love, and that's what we're all here for. Saturday is going to be fun. 3 p.m. Eastern, as I said, TV Info, MLSsoccer.com, ABC, Unimas, TVA, TSN, all the normals. We'll have the pregame show, and we'll have a postgame show as well. RSL's dream dies. David Ochoa, couldn't continue on for him. And boy, you would have thought that the most important thing after that one was Ochoa being out, which tells you something about the character development that he ushered in over the course of these playoffs for the rest of MLS fan bases. The memes and the shush emojis were coming thick and fast. But no Sebastian Blanco. Didn't even need him, Kalen. Got Felipe Mora 5 minutes in. Santiago Moreno, brilliant individual goal. And Gio Savarese in knockout rounds, whether it be MLS's back, whether it be the MLS Cup playoffs, whether it be NASL before that, the man just knows how to how to push the right buttons, and he's been pushing the right buttons since late summer, and here they are.
Yeah, Portland was aggressive from the beginning and were rewarded early with that goal that came off a mistake from Herrera with some poor clearance that went straight to Mora and tucked it in. But RSL was actually still okay up until, you know, I think down 1-0 at halftime is still a relatively comfortable position for this team, mainly because we know how they sort of switch the team in the second half and kind of turn the game on its head. We've seen it time and time again. And then they press late. But the killer was really that second half goal where Moreno is able to kind of just drive into that huge hole into the middle of midfield that RSL had vacant. And, I really think that RSL missed Everton Luiz. I don't know if it's been talked about enough, but just how important he is as far as kind of plugging up that middle, covering ground, because that was just wide open. I don't think RSL had the personnel to really adjust for that. And then on the other side, they made an interesting personnel decision. Pablo decided to go with Anderson Julio from the start, which he had been so fantastic coming off the bench for so long this season, scoring goals. I think he won the prestigious extra time. What was the award he won again?
El Seno Award?
El Seno Super Sub of the Year. Come on, you were part of this.
Yeah, so like I don't know if that just hyped him up so much that he was like, we got to go from the start. But it was, I'd say, a choice that didn't end up working in this favor because he wasn't able to stretch the field or getting behind. He wasn't. Portland seemed pretty comfortable and said, hey, give the ball to his feet and let him figure it out. And when he tried to beat two or three guys, get some space down the end line, it wasn't working for them. They did find some joy on the right-hand side through Herrera, who had that nice cross in the box that one time where he got to the end line and hit it to Krylak and good save from Steve Clark there. But they didn't have that second goal, and I think that middle and midfield spot really killed RSL, and that's where Portland were really able to put it away. So, disappointing for RSL, but, you know, incredible season. You have to say probably the story of the playoffs, even if, you know, whoever wins in a way, it's kind of tough to say, but they were really this incredible story for the playoffs and a team that had been counted out so many times, including by myself. but I don't think it was like a bold pick to pick against them. It was just the fact that this team really defied the odds. And
they,
credit to Pablo,
they won a game without taking a single shot. So yeah, they defied the odds. Yeah.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. By every measurement.
At least the most critical. Yeah,
looking forward, they have a lot of, you can see the quality. There is a lot of quality there. And even when we said, I think during the season, what open job, I think we did this thing on Extra Time, what open job looks the most appealing? And I said RSL because they were still in the playoffs when they lost their manager. And so there was a lot of quality there. It just needed to kind of have that energy behind it that Pablo clearly gave in spades. So I would imagine he's going to get that head coaching job if he wants it, or unless somebody else comes in and snatches him up first, because he did a fantastic job through the playoffs.
Doyle, what's your take on this Timbers resurgence and Gio's role in it?
I mean,
and the way they sort of went from, like you said, embarrassment, because it wasn't just Sounders, it was that Austin game too.
Yeah.
To hosting MLS Cup, to having a transformative moment for them.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm hoping that there's a tell-all behind-the-scenes look at what must have been a couple of very intense team meetings around then. Tactically, you know, it's been, I think he's been a little more conservative with the positioning of the fullbacks, which is huge. Paredes has come in and played basically every minute down the stretch, and I think he's been huge because with him and Chara next to each other, it's tough to operate through that central midfield. So those two things have been big. Getting Blanco healthy for most of the last 2 months was huge. Santiago Moreno has added some quality, as we saw in this game. Jimmy Chara settling, like there's a bunch of stuff that just seemed to click at the right time. All that said, the biggest thing is they just stopped giving up set piece goals. And I can't, like, I've gone back and I've watched their set piece defense from, you know, the start of the year and watched it from the end of the year. And I can't tell exactly what they're doing differently. But they haven't given up a set piece goal since mid-August. And they were the worst team in the league defensively on set pieces up to that point. They have been the
best piece, the best team in the league defensively on set pieces. It didn't really come into play on this one. This was born out of the high press and attacking in numbers. They have such great team speed. Basically everyone except David's favorite player, Felipe Mora. But they like
best shin in MLS.
But like, if you have so much team speed that you're putting the opposing defense under constant pressure, then you just need a guy who knows with the right spots to be in the box, and that is your guy Felipe. And then it's kind of the discussion that we had about NYCFC writ a little bit smaller, because the gap between RSL and Portland isn't quite so large in terms of the spend. But like, when they signed Santiago Moreno, I got messages from a number of front offices, folks who work in front offices around the league, being like, keep an eye on this guy. This is a really good signing for them. And they've kind of slow played it. It hasn't, like, he hasn't needed to be a match winner. But then he got a chance to break this one open in the second half, and he killed the game. He just killed the game. Special players like that in big moments, it's what you need in the playoffs. Defensive solidity, it's what you need in the playoffs. It's a really good formula for Portland, and the fact that they were able to impose it upon RSL, even without Blanco, who is still their best player, it says a lot about the depth they've been able to build in this squad.
The two things that popped out to me in this game in particular was, this was the only playoff game where they started well.
Yeah.
Right. They give up a goal 15 minutes in against Minnesota. They're on their heels. Colorado controlled the first 40 minutes. So to lose Blanco and Espria and create an atmosphere where your team's going to come out and take this game, which I think was the right call, obviously, from Gio Savarese, to let his young players sort of settle in and not have the opportunity to chase, really shows you, I think, where they're at mentally. And we talked about with Philly of like that next man up. This is the best game I've ever seen Marvin Loria play. Mm-hmm. And then you bring in Santiago Moreno as well, who has a great game. And so I think the trust that Gio was able to generate, the confidence he's able to generate from those guys was huge. And that, to me, is where Portland won this game. To open it up, to take the momentum. I think Doyle texted us like 15 minutes right before the goal, right? And was like, Portland's buzzing right now.
Yeah.
Like they were, or I guess after, because the goal was so early. But they were everywhere. Moreno was everywhere. He's dropping deep and picking up the ball. He's beating guys in the middle, beating guys outside. Like, it was just pure chaos. And I think to get the crowd into it, to create an atmosphere where RSL maybe didn't feel like they could win for the first time in the playoffs, I think all of that was necessary and was key. And so that, to me, is why I think this is the best performance I've seen from Portland in a month. Because decision day, was a kind of whatever for them. And then you have the playoffs where they've done enough, but they were not dominant for 90 minutes. And I thought you saw that in this game. And the other thing about Anderson Julio that popped out to me is he's so athletic, and they tried to help him generate chances on the press. And Portland can just play through you. I mean, when you've got Chara, Paredes is comfortable in that space. He's not as dangerous going forward as Williamson is. And then those two fullbacks, I've mocked them defensively, but they're clean on the ball. Yeah. And if you press them, they're happy, because now they've got two options and they know they can create. And I thought Loria was really big in that space as well. And as Portland broke and broke and broke RSL's press, it became it has to be Herrera driving from deep to generate a chance for us. Rusnak was invisible. And at that point, RSL really didn't have a counterattack or an attacking outlet. And once they got into possession, they were not dangerous.
Talk about NYCFC doing it without Tati. You know, he's got to be the most relieved man in MLS, Tati Castellanos. But look,
you can see him in the celebration. Yeah,
Sebastian Blanco and Dairon Asprilla have to also be breathing a big sigh of relief. Not only do they miss out, and look, Blanco, you can't blame. He had an injury, but Dairon had a similar brain fart, let's say, when it came to ill-advised actions on the field that resulted in suspension. Well, now they get the host. Now they're the ones that are welcoming NYCFC in. Now they're the ones that appears will be ready. We don't know how ready Sebastian Blanco will be. We'll do the full MLS Cup preview on Thursday, of course. Let's just have a quick first look right now. Again, 3 p.m. Eastern, Saturday, ABC, Unimas, TSN, TVA.
Can I start with a question?
Sure.
I assume Dairon starts. Who do you take out of the starting lineup?
I think Moreno comes out.
I assume Moreno starts for you as well.
Yeah.
But who would be your attacking four for the Timbers?
Well, do we think Dairon and Blanco are back, or just Dairon?
Well, we know Dairon's back because it was a red.
Right, but do we think, because if you're asking for the attacking four, so if Blanco's health is good to go, he's in the
starting. Yeah, we got to address Blanco.
I would assume Blanco will not be healthy to start.
But he did not. He did not have to play in this match, which is that's a huge feather in the cap for the Timbers to say, well, we got it done without him. We didn't have to push him. We didn't have to test him. No big deal. We talked about it on the show last night, the postgame show. And so I think it's probably apt that we have that conversation again. And Kalen, let you sort of handle the Blanco side of it, because you've had a hamstring injury that you thought would keep you out of MLS Cup, and then you played and you scored. What is Sebastian Blanco thinking, doing, telling Gio Savarese probably this morning?
Well, I was surprised to see him on the bench, because the way he went down in Colorado, I mean, he was emotional. He looked to be uncomfortable at minimum and in pain. So that was hamstrings, from what I know, do not heal that quickly. But I know the fact that he was even able to be on the bench, I wasn't sure if that was more gamesmanship at first or if it was potentially just throw the kitchen sink and, hey, we might need to use you. And I will say from experience that having MLS Cup in front of you will make you do some risky things. Like, you will risk it all to go out there and be a part of that. And the ability to make those choices, I think they will give him to the last day to decide how he's feeling. And I would imagine they're also probably going to train a couple of different ways throughout the week. So they will train with him in the starting lineup. They will train with him out of the starting lineup. And that front four will probably be decided kind of as it goes. And then a conversation will happen. And that's one where, from my perspective, I actually wasn't going to start in the final. Right before we got in the flight to go to LA, I went into the office and fought for my position. And
what was your case? Can I hear just like the boiled down version of your case?
The boiled down version. Well, yeah, it was complicated because I knew I was playing with a hamstring anyways. And I like against Kansas City, I knew I wasn't going to make it long. And I went and played anyways. And then once I got to the point where I thought it was going to go, the hamstring went. But I was back training well the week leading up to and trying to make it a difficult decision. And then ultimately I was able to kind of like earn the trust to get on. And I thought I had done it through my performances throughout the playoffs. It's going to be a very different conversation for Sebastian Blanco. I don't think he's going to need to like prove his quality or say he had a good week in training. Like, that's going to be a very different situation. But it also, I was desperate to play, and I ended up going out and scoring a goal in the first half. I think partly because I wanted to repay the faith to get on the pitch and to be a part of it. And I would imagine Blanco will be in the ear of Gio all week being like, hey, I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good.
Every goal he scores in training, he's just like, yeah, you saw that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's unthinkable that at first I was like, oh, there's no way. I think he's done for the year. And then it was like, oh, he's on the bench? That might be gamesmanship. And now I'm thinking he might actually be able to start in this one, and you maybe take a risk. And part of the reason I also think, just besides just what a great player he is the personality side of it. I think he psychologically sets the tone for this team. We've seen it in some rash challenges at times where he, you know, flies into a tackle, the way he, you know, jaws with other players or other managers on the sidelines, even like that. He kind of sets the emotional tone of this Timbers team. And I think the idea that you could go with him from the start, and potentially, even if that is a risk, I could see that a risk that Portland might be willing to take. I know it sounds crazy, but I wouldn't be surprised based on what I know of him, and I think how important he is to that team.
With that context, Dave, who would your four be for Gio right now? Would it be Mora or Nijgoda?
No, I asked the question.
No,
I don't
turn it back on you.
Answer. No, someone else answer. Because I don't know.
To me, Dairon comes in for Moreno, and then you still have Moreno off the bench. The big question ultimately is Blanco. Like, you could go more on Nijgoda. I don't think it matters that much. They've both shown that they can do it. Nijgoda has been a great player off the bench for them this year. So if I had to guess, I would guess that they go Mora. You're right. Marvin Loria had an amazing game, and midfield is a place that NYCFC absolutely dominates. So to have that number in there and not have to worry about Blanco's hamstring and any of the sort of chasing or harrying or responsibility aspects of that, to me, then it would make sense just logically based on a hamstring injury and the fact that he didn't play in this last match that Blanco is your sort of like That's your card off the bench. But I understand that Sebastian Blanco will not see it that way at all. So, yeah, I mean, that's the big question. That's the, you know, that's the domino. Can Sebastian Blanco make a case to Gio, whether it be in his performances in training, physically with the training staff, or just emotionally within the team, that he has to be there? He's also negotiating a contract, too, I believe, at this point, to stay long-term. It seems both sides want that to continue. I mean, this is like a legend moment. This is where you make your legend in front of your home crowd with a trophy on the line. That's a big, long way of me saying that I think it's going to be Asprilla, Jimmy Chara, Mora, and then a big TBD. I don't know. We know Tati's coming back, though, Doyle. How does that change NYCFC? I mean, it changes everything, really, on both sides.
Yeah, he's their best player. He's the Golden Boot winner. He, you know, I poke some fun at his finishing from time to time, because he does have a knack for missing sitters, but it doesn't get to him at all. And we saw that in the last game. Like, he missed it so badly, he didn't even get a chance to shoot the sitter that he had against the Revs. And then 20 minutes later, he, you know, heads home from 4 yards. He's so good at just being relentless and finding those types of chances. Obviously, he's a wonderful link player as well. He's much more than just a goal scorer in the attacking third, which is why I thought Domi Toron played him out of position on the wing for a year and a half. And Ronnie Dyla has obviously unlocked a lot of the true number nine stuff. And then on top of that, he's the best defensive forward in the league. He's just a nightmare to play against. And those Timbers center backs have been really good over the past couple of months. They're not great against super mobile forwards. They're not necessarily the best at trying to play through a press. And one thing that we've watched or we've seen happen a lot in these playoffs is that, like, the NYCFC win over Philly, which came down to tactical adjustments and a big second half shift, that was kind of an outlier. What's been more defining is that whoever comes out and sets the tone and is sort of like winning the intensity battle from the start, that's been the team that has usually gone on to win the game. Now, there've still been comebacks and rallies within that, but like even the RSL win over Sporting Kansas City, like RSL was just the better team from the start. And like when they brought on the subs in the second half, that wasn't a tactical shift. That was just personnel, and they wore Kansas City down. So having Tati out there from the start is obviously very, very good for NYCFC on a lot of levels. But maybe the biggest one is because like he's going to be running around with his hair on fire from the moment the ball is kicked. He is a tempo setter and a tone setter in a way that there aren't a lot of center forwards who do that the way he does. And that is huge. And I think that in this game, you really, really want to win the first 15 minutes. You want to be the one who, especially because NYCFC are much better with the ball than without it, you really want to be the one like planting the flag and saying this is how the game is going to play out.
And for NYCFC also, you're on the road, but it's a noon local kick. If you can kind of put the crowd to sleep a little at the beginning, that's big for you. And to what Doyle said, like that's what Tati did against the Revs. His pressing, his energy, the way he closed passing lanes and made things difficult allows the whole team to step 5-6 yards higher and changes the area that NYCFC plays in. And I think to Dyla's point and what we saw in the conference final, him not existing meant that NYCFC just played deeper and every single player on the field was starting at a deeper position. And so he is that's why it's odd when I think we talk about him. He's the Golden Boot winner, fact. But what he's the emotional leader of this team. And when he's on the field, it's just a whole different group. I think we're all glad that after what happened, we still get to see him one more time and get to see him in a game like this with the way he's developed. And he's a different test for this Portland backline, right? Because they played Colorado, and no disrespect, Kalen, Dom Baggi started up top. They play Minnesota. It's who knew? And now you play RSL with Rubin and Demir Krylov dropping off. But what Tati does, the way he moves, is completely different.
Big game. The final game. This is it. MLS Cup 2021. Providence Park, Portland Timbers, NYCFC, 3 p.m. Eastern, December 11th. That is Saturday, folks. can watch on ABC in Canada, TSN TVA in Spanish, Unimas. We will have the full preview on Thursday. I'm ready. This is it. This is it. If you have any storylines, any questions, any comments, any hot takes, any predictions, any fill in the blank, 401-206-0MLS, extra time at MLSsoccer.com. We will dig into all of it on Thursday, and we're happy to have your input on all of that as well. A big story in MLS today, breaking news as we're recording this podcast. There has been we've known that the lower division league for MLS has been coming out for a while. We didn't know what it was called. We didn't know who was participating to start. We didn't know what the details were going to be. We now know the name is MLS Next Pro. That continues the professional pathway from MLS Next, which we have talked about a bunch since last year, but now we know that. We have a league president. We have a senior vice president of competition operations, Charles Olczyk, who's been doing a ton of work at the league office for a long time when it comes to expansion and other big projects, will be the president of this league. Ali Curtis, who just exited Toronto, of course, will be coming back. He was at the league office prior to going to the Red Bulls. He'll be the senior vice president of competition operations, basically figuring out the soccer side of this thing. 21 clubs will compete in the inaugural 2022 season. One will be an independent club. We know that's Rochester New York FC. Jamie Vardy, a co-owner of the club, will chat with us in just a second here. The other 20 clubs are associated with MLS teams: Chicago, Houston, NYCFC, San Jose, Colorado, Kansas City, Orlando, Seattle, Columbus, Miami, Philadelphia, St. Louis. That's a big one. Cincinnati, Minnesota, Portland, Toronto, Dallas, New England, Salt Lake, and Vancouver. And then more joining in 2023. You can find the news at MLSsoccer.com. All the details there. We'll give your
favorite segment we've ever done. He got to read a list.
Just, I know. I knew as soon as I went through that list. You see how that just flowed for me? It was just so easy. Just pop, 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 pop. And here we are. Let's take a listen to what Jamie Vardy has to say, and then we'll give some quick thoughts before we get out of here. It's an AT&T 5G call to the field, the co-owner, of Rochester New York FC. All right, it's an AT&T 5G call to the field, all the way to England. Jamie Vardy, an owner of Rochester New York FC in MLS Next Pro. What's up, Jamie? You're used to being called a player, a goal scorer, an international. You're an owner now, man. How's it feel?
Oh, it's brilliant. It's all just tying into one at the minute.
Did you, I was reading that you had been looking for opportunities to own a team in North America. And I have to wonder, when you look around the dressing room and with England or with Leicester or wherever you are in the world, you got to be the only person you know that's trying to do that, right? Or there are a bunch of others. Were you on your own in this journey?
Well, as far as I'm aware, yeah. there was a few that we looked at, and I think it all came down to from day one and the chats we're having, it was always going to be Rochester.
Tell me why you want to be an owner, man. Like, what is it about this that attracts you?
I think it's something different, obviously, to what I'm used to, but I've seen it firsthand with our owners are at my club right now. So I know from what they've done and how they help with the community and how they help with the local area, the fans, what they do for them. It really brings that value to the club that everyone wants to be a part of. So I think I'll definitely be taking a lot of that with me forward.
MLS Next Pro, you're the first team. You are, to my knowledge, the first team outside of quote-unquote MLS teams. I'm trying to imagine being in your shoes in that sense. And as an owner, if I was you, I'd be like, we're about to beat up on these teams. Like, I would be actively competitive in that way to sort of prove myself. How do you feel about the soccer side of this?
No, that's exactly what we want to do. We want to be going in there and beating all these teams. We want to show them that we're competitive, that we're going to be the team that the other teams need to be beating. And I think being the first just makes it that extra special, especially with obviously the success that Rochester had in the past and then unfortunately had to go on hiatus. So we see this as a new beginning, a new chapter, and hopefully lots of success to come.
New beginning, new chapter, new information for a lot of us. I'm sure some of the folks listening here are just trying to wrap their minds around what MLS Next Pro is. From your point of view, help them understand. Help the owner of the first team. You know, you got the platform, man. Tell them what this is all about.
Well, I think, like you said, for the MLS teams at the minute, it's another stepping stone for their academy players to keep developing and have the chance of getting in their first team. But for us, it's about beating them. We want to beat them. We want to show that we're the better team. But from my side personally, it's we have a player that we've signed who's been phenomenal in beating your teams. Now you want to sign him. We want to be the ones that show him the way forward and possibly change his life.
So you're trying to beat him, then sell to them. Is that what I'm hearing here? Take the points, then get the money, right? That sounds pretty good.
It might not just be them. Like I said, there's been plenty of players that have gone across to Europe from the States as well. So might not just be obviously selling to the MLS. It'll be looking further afield as well.
So you have a unique career in the sense that I just feel like a lot of these players that you sign, you will be able to identify with them in a way that most people can't. I was listening earlier as Charlie Bohm interviewed you, and folks out there can check out that piece at MLSsoccer.com. And one of the things you talked about that I think is really easy for a lot of people to identify with, not just soccer players, is having a dream and feeling like it might be over, feeling like that you might have come up short, sometimes through no fault of your own. Like, this feels like an ownership, an opportunity for you to give that dream to kids. I have to imagine that means a lot to you.
Yeah, it's massive. And I think you summed it up. It's back then when I had that dream took away from me, there wasn't many new chances available, if you like to put it like that. So I think with us, whether you've been released or you've just gone unnoticed, you're just playing in the park with your mates. It's about getting that opportunity and maybe having that second chance to prove yourself. And there's definitely no way that we'll be turning anyone down when it comes to situations like that.
What did that second chance mean to you personally when you got it? I mean, you know, Sheffield Wednesday, Boyhood Club, it doesn't work out. And for thousands of kids, it doesn't work out. But you somehow found your way back to it. And what did that second chance mean?
No, it was massive, but it didn't just happen overnight. I mean, I was playing with my mates on a Sunday, managed to get playing semi-pro then on a Saturday, but still got a full-time job. So it come to...
What were you doing?
I was working in a factory making carbon fiber splints for people with drop foot, which helped them walk more naturally instead of the toes scraping on the floor. I mean, obviously it was over the moon with what I was doing. I was helping someone anyway, so. But it did take its toll. I mean, if we had a Tuesday night game, I've just done a 8-9 hour shift at work. I'm driving, stopping off at a local service station, takeaway, just to get a bit of food just before the game. So it was really hard, but I probably wouldn't change it because it's made me the person I am today and probably made me have the career that I have.
What are those opportunities give kids or give players to make that next step? Like, what is it about that opportunity for you that sort of set you up to make a jump that I think really, I mean, a lot of people can look at it and on paper, it does feel like a little bit of a fairy tale. I know you probably smile at that one and be like, oh, come on, you know, you're overdoing this. But what did those chances mean to you as a soccer player?
No, it was, like I said, it was something that I definitely needed. I mean, I went through, when I left, it was Stocksbridge for Halifax. So it was Halifax. Within 3 years, I'd signed for three different clubs. But every one of them clubs was another jump up, another jump up, another jump up. So just knowing that people did back me and did believe in what I was doing and my ability, obviously it makes you feel more wanted, makes you want to have that drive to succeed. And I mean, that's still how I am today. It doesn't matter how old I am or what I've won. I've still got that hunger and drive that I want to keep going.
I don't think you've been to Rochester yet, right? The pandemic has kept you away?
Yeah, it has, unfortunately.
So I'm no expert here on either on English geography and culture nor upstate New York geography and culture. But if I was going to guess, I'm going to just put it out there. Look, people from Sheffield, people from Rochester, let us know. I got to think there are some similarities to sort of upstate New York with the history that it has, with sort of the blue-collar attitude that you have up there. And then Sheffield, where you come from. Have you felt any of those similarities? Did that draw you in at all?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd probably say one thing that's not the same. I mean, I'm actually looking forward to getting out there in the snow. We don't really get that much snow here, and it's boring when it comes to like winter and Christmas time. So can't wait for that. But yeah.
And you get
It is similar.
You have history too. You have history as well with this club. You're not just like you're not plucking something out of nowhere and just dropping it down. I mean, this is the Rhinos now to Rochester New York FC. I mean, the Rhino name isn't there, but this team has a lot of history.
Yeah.
Deep in the pyramid, deep in the Open Cup, winning the Open Cup, the last independent team to do so. You're not just like throwing something down upstate.
No, not at all. Like I said, the history is there. It's had the success, and unfortunately with a hiatus, it just put that little hole in there. But just because we've slightly changed the name, and it wasn't something that we took very easily to do either. It was more of a, because of the hiatus and how long there's not been any team there, it was more of a, like a fresh start, new beginnings. Let's make sure we remember what happened in the past, but now we bring more success in this next chapter.
What kind of owner are you going to be? Yeah, how do you experience these games? I asked David Beckham this question. He said he was going to be pretty nervous. You think it's going to go better for you than David?
No, I think I'll be nervous, obviously, when I'm watching the games and stuff like that. But I think from my experiences of seeing how the owners have been at the clubs I've been at, that there's a lot of positives and a lot of good that I can actually bring and use it as experience to make the club better.
Last one, we'll let you get out of here, Jamie. We always wonder, what's it like across the pond, so to speak, when people think or talk or have MLS come through their little sphere? How often do you see it? Do you see it on TV? Do you watch games? Do you see players? And, you know, if you see Alphonso Davies in the Champions League and think, oh, wait, he came from MLS. How much of a connection do you have? How much knowledge do you have?
No, I have quite a bit. I mean, good things, Sky Sports is brilliant. No matter what time of day it is, there's always football matches on. So it doesn't matter what it is. I've always been one of them who likes to watch any football. I still now on BT Sport is they've got the conference games on where I used to play when I was at Fleetwood. And if one of them's on, I'll watch that. I was watching the FA Cup replay with Stockport and Wigan the other night, buzzing because Stockport got the win. It's a nice underdog story. But yeah, no, I've watched the MLS game. Obviously, not the ones that are on at 2 o'clock in the morning. I need my beauty sleep for training the next day. But no, you have to watch them. And it just shows, like I said, how much it has progressed over the years for it to be on as much as it is.
All right, man. You gonna spread the word in the locker room? We're going to see like some other guys rolling over? And you see a scattering of owners? Like, man, Jamie owns a club. I got to get a club.
Who knows? I mean, obviously all my dressing room know exactly what I'm doing, so I'm sure they'll be very intrigued.
All right, just the beginning. Up Fleetwood Town, up Rochester New York FC, up MLS Next Pro. Jamie Vardy, thank you so much for joining us, man.
Cheers. Thank you.
All right, big thanks to Jamie for joining the show. He's got owner next to his name now. Seems like he's starting to get comfortable, or at least a little bit more comfortable with that. Dave, we've leaned on you a lot when it comes to MLS Next and the academy side of things and development, because you are so familiar with that area of the soccer culture here. What do you think about this pro pathway having another piece in between the academy side and the first team?
I just think when you start at looking at the U.S. men's national team, everything that's happening, and you watch Champions League and all this stuff, what's been going on over the last 7 years in terms of youth development in this country has been working. Whether it's perfect, I don't think anyone would argue that, but it's been working. And I think this is another step in that process. And the main thing is just control and flexibility for these clubs. And so when you look at what this will mean for these teams, I think you'll have a lot of scenarios where the Philadelphia Union have a game on Saturday night and Brandon Craig is on the bench and Quinn Sullivan's on the bench and they don't get minutes. And then you can kind of flex them into a game on Sunday at a professional level and get them more minutes and get them more experience. And what we've seen from these young players is a player like Nathan Harriel being prepared to play in a conference final is because he's gotten so many minutes at that professional level coming out of the academy. And so I think this setup allows MLS teams to control their youth pathway just a little bit more and move players around and move players to the right level, challenge players, have your style of play top to bottom. That's what Nico Estevez was, his expertise was coming out of Columbus, like those types of things. We've seen all of that work for youth development. And so I think this is just another step in that path of saying now an MLS team really does control from U9, if you want, all the way through to first team and that professional experience. They control what that player's experience can be. And that we've seen be effective so far.
You're also hearing what Jamie had to say about, look, they want to develop players. They want to move those players once they're ready, whether that be MLS or otherwise, but they also want to win and have a high competitive standard. And my hope for this, and look, it's going to be sort of a TBD as the league develops and grows and sort of comes in its own place in this development structure we have. My hope is that you see MLS Next teams that are quote unquote the independent ones, because it's not just MLS teams and MLS Next, have an opportunity to sort of widen their pathway as well. I mean, the more ground we cover, the more players we give opportunities to in this country, the more impact they can have, right? And ultimately, that's what it's about developing players to be ready for the next opportunity, whatever it is, whether it be the jump to MLS or it be, you know, to college or, you know, whatever it is that is right for them in their path. This is just another step on that ladder. So we'll get more details in the coming months, and we'll see what happens in 2022 when play starts. I think the season, if I understand correctly here, is going to be March to September. And we'll talk about this a whole lot more. If you have thoughts, hit us up. Let's get into the mailbag. We have anything good here? Actually, we have our Sky Sports First Look with Kalen Carr. I forgot about that. Every Monday, Kalen does Sky Sports before he comes on with us. And every Monday, we ask him, Kalen, what is Sky Sports asking you about? What are they interested in? And today they are very interested in Chris Armas to Man U. Yeah, right. Sorry. No. Inter Miami and Phil. No. Now it's Chris Armas to Man U. We probably should just end the show on this, right? This is big news, not just in like U.S. soccer, not just in our little MLS world, across the globe to millions and millions and millions, maybe billions of Manchester United fans. What were the questions like? Kalen, and what do we think about this development? On one hand, it's, you know, Jesse Marsh is out at RB Leipzig. On the other hand, his former assistant is now an assistant at Manchester United under Ralf Rangnick.
Yeah, it was quite the wake-up call this morning, because sometimes, I'll be honest, sometimes, you know, we'll have conversations there, and I'm like, how does this all fit in? You know, where it's like, where I'm commenting on, you know, I often comment on a lot of young players that are playing in Europe, or, you know, the happenings of who's the next big talent coming out of MLS. There's a lot of interest in that. Inter Miami is often a big topic of conversation for obvious reasons as well. But yeah, this one, I felt pretty well placed, actually, just with being, you know, former teammate, and actually I was managed by Armas, even when he was a teammate, to be honest. That was just kind of, he was always my coach, Coach Armas to me. But yeah, I mean, it was, I would say, a big surprise. So I saw Taylor Twellman break the news, credit to him, as always, on top of things. But also, when you started to look a little bit deeper at it, maybe less so. The line of questioning from Sky, though, was skeptical. Like, I gave my experience playing for Chris and like what he's like, his quality, you know, first as a player and then as a coach, and the success he's had as an assistant. I did mention how he, you know, had not had success or not had as much success, especially as of late with TFC just making it 12 matches. And I believe their follow-up question was, why would a Manchester United supporter feel okay about a manager, an American manager coming from MLS to who had just been let go after 12 games in charge of Toronto FC? And my answer was pretty simple. To me, the whole, you know, not to go too deep into the Man U project, but that's going to be decided by Rangnick. You know, it's going to be his decision to whether they succeed or fail. And Armas has been incredibly successful, especially as an assistant manager in MLS. And he understands the system, the philosophy. And I think that's what Manchester United is valuing here. And it doesn't have to do with the place where you come from, because he's basically a part of that Red Bull family and philosophy that they're now trying to sort of pick up and place into this new context. It will be a different dressing room for Armas to walk into, obviously. Like, it's not, there aren't a lot of Kalen Carrs in there, you know, Cuauhtemoc Blancos even. It is another level. But one thing I know about Armas is he will never change. He's like, there's nothing, I don't think there is another speed for him. He is like disciplined, intense, focused, and will be able to help implement this idea of the press because he knows it so well. So I'm very excited for Armas. It was kind of funny because, you know, some of the, even just the questioning will show that that's still, there is still a gulf in the way that American managers are perceived, or just Americans, I guess, are perceived abroad. But I don't think it's that, I mean, to me, it is less about where you're from and how good you are at the job. And I think that that's why, this has happened. So I'm rooting for him and, hell, I'd love to go over there and see again. He's probably gonna have a lot of people hitting him up.
So,
or, you know, VIP experiences or all that. But I feel like I've been a good servant to Armas over the years. So, you know, good friend. And I'll be happy to watch him from afar.
So by never changing.
It's an incredible story, though.
You mean he's still going to take the Manhattan Bridge to the Midtown Tunnel to get to Man U training every day?
Well, I was going to say, I was surprised he took the TFC job.
Right.
I was like,
he was never going to leave Long Island. Now he's lived in two countries in 5 months.
I was like, okay, I guess Manchester United, that you might get a work permit and hop a plane for that, for sure.
Any other thoughts, guys? I mean, there's a lot of things going on with American managers in Europe. Well, I'll open it up if you guys have any thoughts about Jesse Marsh, too. I mean, that, speaking of the press, it just seemed like that didn't
work. Yeah, you can't,
didn't work.
You can't make that system work unless you get complete buy-in from the players. And over the last couple of years, under Nagelsmann, that RB Leipzig team, they hybridized. They weren't the full Red Bull. And Jesse was trying to take them back to the full Red Bull, and it looked like the players never really bought into it. It's going to be interesting to see where his landing spot is. I would imagine every team in MLS that has a open head coaching position will be calling Jesse's agent. I doubt he wants to come back to MLS at this point. I suspect that he'll end up somewhere else in Europe. I think big club in a smaller league, kind of like how David Wagner went from the Bundesliga. He's now managing Young Boys, and he has them in the Champions League. Something like that makes a lot of sense for Jesse. Ragnick is the same way, though. Ragnick is full press all the time. I have trouble imagining Marcus Rashford, Bruno Fernandes, bunch of other, not to mention Cristiano Ronaldo. I have trouble imagining them pressing through their man for 90 minutes, which is what the system requires. It is going to be a very interesting experiment to see whether he can get these players to buy in, or to see whether he is going to have to moderate his approach, which is something that he had for 15 years. He had always been very loath to do. I mean, they would sell players who were really good players but weren't completely bought in. Really interesting.
The flip side of that, though, is Chris was, he was kind of hybridizing what they were doing here years ago.
He was.
Right?
Well, he was trying to.
He was trying.
Right.
Whether it's successful or not is
correct. That's what he wanted to do. He wasn't like, hey, 90 minutes of press, here we come. He was, I think there's a middle ground.
Yeah.
So
the only thing I'd say about Jesse Marsh, which I just think is harsh, is they sold the best young center back on the planet, and I think one of the most underrated players in the world in Marcel Sabitzer, and didn't really replace them. They've had COVID issues as well, and so it's been a tough I don't think any manager would have been different. So, well, that's the part that's tough, I think, for Jesse Marsh is, yeah, he took over a great club with quality and all these things, but there were holes in this team coming into the year. And, yeah, he wasn't able to fill other spots. It felt like they had upgraded the attack, especially center forward. And that's where the advantage was supposed to come. And Solbjaer being in the group now as well. But it felt like he never really got all those pieces together. But Bob Bradley, former Chivas USA guy, LAFC. We've talked about Robin Fraser, the connection. Come on, Jesse Marsh. Bob.
The interesting thing to me, if you're a manager looking for positions right now, if you have ambition to go to Europe, being involved in the Red Bull organization or NYCFC, that feels like a really good pathway to getting abroad, because people are picking and philosophy often over the place that you come from, which has not always been the case in MLS. I think that's sort of another interesting piece of this story that'll be interesting to watch as far as how not just player movement, but because we see a lot of that coming in and going abroad, and the players have a much easier pipeline now to Europe through MLS than the managers do. But through these sort of unique pathways and partnerships, you're seeing that start to break through as well on the manager side.
Isn't that why Struber's here? Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the connection that this club has back to Europe is, I think, the way you get a guy who's been, who was already successful in England to come here. And so we've seen it already sort of play out. And
oh, Barnsley. Barnsley might be an interesting place for Jesse Marsh to end up. They need some help right now.
But just look, honestly, the fact that his name would be not just plausible, but attractive to clubs who have Champions League ambitions. Think about that for U.S. coaches for a second. That has not been the case literally ever. And he will have some of those opportunities, I expect. We'll see what happens. And it's also a good thing to have connections to this MLS market. Like, hey, I know the market. You know, Club Bruges, go out and spend $7 million on Tejan. There's a bunch of young players coming out of here. There's established players. There's young South Americans. Like, there is a selling point here. Jesse Marsh, I think, will land on his feet. It'll just be very, very interesting to see where he lands. Congratulations to Chris Armas. Man U. Whew. Man U. That's all you got to say. All right, that's it for us. Hit us up if you have any thoughts on MLS Cup. We'll do the full deep dive with Charlie on Thursday. 401-206-0 MLS. Extra time at MLSsoccer.com. Hope you have a great week, everybody. We will see you then. Adios.